On this week's Ticket Stubs, we're talking about a blockbusting mind-bender of a film from Christopher Nolan. As to which one, why, my sweet boy, I'll give you a hint. When it came out, there were people everywhere thinking they were so smart for understanding it. And if you didn't follow it, you were dumb. Then he followed it up with Tenet, making those very people themselves look like dum-dums. That's right, we're talking about Inception from 2010.
Wow.
Ryan, would you like to go?
I would love to go. So, you know how Christopher Nolan recently released his movie Tenet, which was about time manipulation? Well, today's movie plays with the exact same concept of time, except for this one actually makes some sense. Plus, you can hear what the fuck is going on. Today, we're talking about Inception.
I love yours so much, Ryan.
Quality. Oh.
My one's throwing a spanner in the works. This is a bit of a wild card, I think. Because mine, just like Tenet, makes no sense. Okay. The perfect movie. Could we be dreaming? Wake up and smell the Nolan. Christopher Nolan, Hans Zimmer, and the entire Batman cast is back, except for Liam Neeson. This week we watched Inception. Let's jump right into it.
I love the smell of Nolan in the morning.
Who doesn't?
We've had ourselves a very special three-way intro. Our first three-way, boys.
Our first one. Oh, my God.
How are you both?
Very well, thank you. How are you, boys?
Mate, I'm doing good on this beautiful Monday night.
Yeah, we're recording on the start of the week for a change. Well, I've actually got a big week ahead, my buddies. Well, as of this recording, I've just celebrated my 1-year anniversary.
Ooh.
And
oh my goodness.
And it's my birthday by the time this comes out. So,
I'll
be the ripe old age of 32. I can start taking my fish oil tablets and my iron tablets and all sorts of things.
Lord help us, it's Dane's birth week. Yeah. Stay out of his way.
But no, I'm good. It's a busy old week.
That's good to hear.
That's great to hear,
so, mate. Another week has come, another movie has been watched, and had you guys seen Inception before?
Yes, this was my very first Christopher Nolan experience. Not from this watching alone, but when Inception came out, that was the first Nolan movie I'd ever seen. I hadn't seen The Batmans, I hadn't seen anything he'd done beforehand, making me look like a real silly Billy.
Ryan is judging you so hard right now.
Yeah, wow.
I can feel the radiation, and I apologize for using rough language like silly Billy so early on.
We're going to need that explic banner across this episode.
I'll be sure to beep out my bawdy talk.
You're going to need to put a course, like a parental guidance warning at the beginning of this one.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Ryan, what about you, buddy?
Well, I've always been a very big Chris Nolan fan. I've seen all of his movies, including Tenet, which I don't want to talk about ever. But yeah, I loved Inception when I first saw it. I saw it at the movies. And I still remember the first time I saw that trailer. I don't know if you guys remember it, but that first trailer was so good. It had all the best shots from the movie in it. Nothing made sense. And then they had that Hans Zimmer score with the big boah noise, and it was just so good. It was just amazing. Yeah, and the movie, it was a damn good movie. I did not think I really understood it until probably the second or third time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was great.
It's a lot to take in the first time you watch it. There's a lot happening. Like, writing my notes for this to spell it all out for people was laborious. It was horrible.
Yeah. Huge.
Well, like I said in my intro, when Inception came out, people were like confused and like, what a dumb dog you are. We're so smart. And then no one understood what the fuck was happening in Tenet. And it really just made Inception seem like child's play. Like, how did I ever find Inception difficult to understand? I've just spent 3 hours not hearing a word of this movie.
Well, it took Christopher Nolan like 10 years to write this script or something like that.
Yeah, he came up with it when he was 16, apparently.
Yeah, which is pretty incredible to actually... Mm. Like, we've all, you know, made little movies and stuff together and with other people, and to make a movie that you thought of when you were 16 and have everybody see it, that's pretty like bucket list shit there.
It's pretty good. Yeah. But like, I can't even imagine the planning that goes into this movie, because there's so many things going on all the time.
I feel so bad.
Yeah, even just trying to wrap your head around it, like, it's just crazy. I haven't read the script, but I think the script would be really interesting to actually read.
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, when you watch the Lord of the Rings movies and you try to imagine, like, them describing, like, Legolas surfing down a whole bunch of orcs on a shield. Like, I always think about that. I'm like, how do they write that into a script?
Yeah.
I'm actually... I don't know if you guys are ready for this. I'm about to rustle some jimmies. I don't know if Inception is really that great. I don't know if it holds up as much as what it did.
Dane, I have to kind of agree with you. I think this is probably the sixth time I watched it. And yeah, I was like, yeah, this is a little bit of a slog. I don't know if it was just because I'd seen it so many times, but I don't know. Yeah.
Mm.
It's like so well made, but I think
one thing...
Oh, it's... Nolan makes an incredible movie. There's no doubt about it. And obviously his ideas for each thing are sort of like really grandiose and bizarre and unique and whatnot. But yeah, I don't know. I think I just prefer him as a director with just kind of... Like, the Batman trilogies were fantastic and everything else. But I'm like, he kind of gets, I don't want to use the word pretentious, or maybe like his ideas get a bit too big for their boots. Like, again, Tenet, no one knows what was fucking going on in Tenet. I don't know, I just would prefer if he just stuck with kind of other material that doesn't make me so head scratchy at the same time. I don't know.
Well, I do agree with you. Like, I'm very excited. Like, as I said, I'm a big fan of his, but like, I can't wait to see his next movie, which is like about Oppenheimer, who made the atomic bomb.
Ooh.
And like, it's got a killer cast already, as you'd expect, but like, hopefully it's a bit more of a smaller story and it's not trying to be the biggest worldly movie you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Mm. There's a lot going on.
Like a smaller character thing that has like real world stakes and obviously real world consequences, but yeah, I think that could be really interesting if he kind of toned it down a little bit for this next one, but who knows?
We'll have to wait and see. I think probably the biggest thing that I realized while watching is like you, Ryan, it was probably like, I've always been a big Nolan fan. This was probably the seventh time I've watched it, sixth or seventh, just like you. And one of the characters, Elliot Page, is in this movie, and their character is... They just ask questions constantly. Like, have you noticed that? Like, that character is literally just there to ask questions more so than it...
That character is
the audience.
Yeah, I was about to say the exact same thing.
Because they're like, oh, what's happening now? And Joseph Gordon-Levitt's like, okay, guys, grab out a notebook. Yeah. And tell you.
Exactly
so
what's happening.
We're doing this.
It's kind of... Those are the type of glaringly, like, when you first watch it, it's one of those movies where if you don't think too hard about it and you just enjoy it at face value, you're like, bloody hell, what a good film that was. But yeah, well, in saying that, shall we jump into it?
Let's do it.
I'm ready.
Let's do it. So, Inception, heist movie and science fiction movie all in one. It's a classic corporate espionage, heisty boy, And it's also got a lot of science that doesn't make any sense, but we're going to go along with it anyway. So we open with Hans Zimmer's thunderous score, the classic wah that we all know and love.
Oh, you broke out the thesaurus for this one, didn't you?
Hey, I'm a well-spoken lady.
Oh, yeah.
When I'm the host. The rest of the time, I'm like, fuck this, fuck that. That was fucking shit. Fun fact, I actually saw Hans Zimmer perform this live when he was in Australia the last time before COVID hit. So
that would have been incredible.
It was incredible. Mm. I was brought to tears. It was amazing. Probably the best concert I've ever been
to. He's had a crazy career.
He has. I didn't even know. Like, he wrote the score for Madagascar. Like, what the hell? I feel like this is like dead set. You know how there's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Mm.
Yes.
There's where I think most of the films we've done, there's like 6 degrees of Marty the Zebra.
I was just saying that. Yeah. Is this a shared universe? Because I brought up Madagascar when we watched Spiral. Yeah.
And then I brought it up again when we watched New Jack City. So it's all coming together.
Marty's at the center.
I love all these crossovers.
Yeah, the MCU, the Madagascar.
Cinematic universe.
Yeah. But yeah, okay. So yeah, we open up with Hans Zimmer's thunderous wah that underscores the whole movie. Like, this is, you're going to hear a lot about the wah. Dominic Cobb wakes up washed ashore on an unknown beach, and he hears the laughter and chatter of children and sees two kids playing in the sand in the distance, and he tries to reach out to them, but he's too fucking tired. So he goes back to being all wet and drowned on the beach. And then he's woken up by an armed guard prodding a rifle into his back, and he doesn't wake up. So the guy goes, hey, you know what? I'm going to search his pockets. That's what you do when you find a guy on the beach. And he's got a bloody pistol tucked into the back of his pants. And the man calls over the other guards in Japanese, and they pick him up. And we cut to a grand dining room where an old man sits at the head of the table, and they tell him, hey, this bloke was found on the beach and he was kind of delirious and stuff, but he said your name and all he had was a gun and a metal spinning top. And the old man's like, whoa, what the fuck? So they bring in Dom, now in handcuffs, and he slurps up a whole bunch of food, and the man questions him about what the heck he's doing there. And he says,
can I just say that the makeup of the old fella. Ken Watanabe. I thought his makeup looked very average.
Yeah. I'll cop that. But yeah, so he's at the other end of the table and he asks Leonardo DiCaprio, which I haven't even mentioned that, but Leonardo DiCaprio is in this movie. And he says, are you here to kill me? And he reveals that he knows what the top is. And he spins it on the table, saying it belonged to a man that he met in a half-remembered dream. A man, he says, who possessed some radical notions. And then we cut to another scene.
Oh, my God.
Set in the same dining room. A younger Japanese man, which it is revealed is Ken Watanabe, now sitting at the head of the table. And Dom doesn't look like he's just drowned now. He's looking very tidy and he's got a very nice haircut. And he asks, what is the most resilient parasite? A bacteria, a virus, an intestinal worm? It is, in fact, an idea. And this is where it is revealed that it's a thick plot. Like, it's a lot to wrap your head around. So it's revealed that Dom and his companion Arthur, who's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, they're extractors and they perform corporate espionage using experimental military technology to infiltrate their target's subconscious and extract information through a shared dream world. And they are, in fact, in the middle of a dream right now, but Ken Watanabe doesn't know it yet. What did you guys think of this opening scene? Did you think it was confusing? Did you like it? What was the crack?
Mm.
Ryan, you go.
Are you throwing that to me, Dana?
Yeah.
I really liked the opening scene, and I don't want to sound too much like an idiot, but I didn't realize that old Ken is from the end of the movie.
What did you think of it, Dane? You look very, you look very perturbed.
You look, yeah, I was going to say, you're like, I do not care.
I'm gonna break out in my thesaurus and say that I'm very flummoxed. No, I liked it. Like, obviously with Nolan, his sets are always incredible, and throughout this whole movie, everything's very stylish. It's like a dream-themed James Bond. There's style coming out your ears. And every dream kind of has like a different theme. So this one's set in Japan. Later on, it's set in Serbia or wherever. It's a globe-trotting adventure.
Yeah, because they set the dreams, which we'll get into when we go further into the film, but they set the dreams for the target that they're trying to extract information from, basically.
I can tell already that this podcast is, this episode, it's going to be...
it's going to be a long one.
Yeah, and it's also going to be a little bit all over the shop, because this movie is.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Can I just bring up one more point? Chris Nolan worked 10 years on this script, and the main character is called Dom Cobb.
What a name.
Which I think is the best name in cinema.
I've got some little trivia for later about some of the names in this movie, but I'll save that for later. But yeah, so to explain how extraction works in this movie, it's pretty out there. It's pretty not possible unless the government's doing some stuff that we don't know about yet. Whoa. In a dream state, your conscious defenses are lowered and it makes your thoughts vulnerable to theft, which is called extraction. And they go to, you go to sleep with some other people and they go into your dream with you and they try to get you to say things and do things until they get the information that they need. Then they leave. So Cobb and Arthur work to extract the information they need from Saito. But Cobb's wife, Mal, arrives and messes everything up. And that's Marion Cotillard. I'm very bad at pronouncing foreign French things.
French names. Yeah.
And Cobb, for some reason, and like, she's like, oh, you know, what are you boys doing here? And he's like, hey, you get out of here. And they go about, like, you know, their little espionage heist. And Cobb, for some reason, trusts his wife's projection, because she's not actually a real person, as we come to find out throughout the movie, to act as an anchor while he rappels out of a window for some reason. He's like, sit here, lady. And he's just like, cool. I'll just jump out of this window while an imaginary person sits in a chair. Fucking sit.
It was
why didn't this work?
It was a very James Bond move in a way.
Very.
Because she's the femme fatale in the movie. And he's like, be my anchor while I just yeet myself out of this window.
And then she gets up and leaves him. And yeah, so then they go in.
Well, he's in a tuxedo as well.
James Bond.
And he has a silenced pistol.
Yeah. Pew, pew. Gold.
Yeah. Nolan's just got the hots of Bond in this
finger.
Movie.
I'm going to be writing the next James Bond movie.
I can't wait not to listen.
No, how dare you. Well, I will make you listen through my constant singing. But yeah, so they, you know, Mull, like, ruins everything for everybody. Basically, they get halfway through the bloody heist. He breaks into a safe and gets the information out, and then Mull shows up with Arthur. He's now a hostage. Saito is also there, and he's like, hey, what the fuck do you think you're doing in my brain, boy? And then so their plan's falling apart now, and Mal shoots Arthur, like, she threatens and she shoots him, and because she's saying, he's, you know, they're like, oh, well, if you get killed in a dream, you wake up. And Mal's like, well, no, if I just hurt him, like, pain is in the mind, he'll just feel the pain, but he won't actually die. So she shoots him. And then in a last-ditch effort, Cobb shoots Arthur in the face, and he wakes up in a grimy apartment instructing another man who was also there, named Nash, to give Cobb a kick to wake up. And I thought it was pretty funny because he's like, oh, yeah, give him the kick. And he's like, what? And he's like, wake him up. And it's like, if he's there, surely you would know, like, how this is all going to work. So Cobb's, like, tied to, he's sitting on a chair above a bathtub. So then they push him into a bathtub full of water and he wakes up. They then wake up Sato. And they are now in this apartment and an angry mob is on their way to absolutely rip the place to shreds. They begin to interrogate him to get information that they were originally trying to get out of him from the previous dream. Because, surprise, we're in a dream right now. When it's also revealed that they are all these boys are sitting on a Shinkansen in Japan and they're asleep. So they were in a dream, then they're in another dream, and then there's reality where they're actually asleep. A teenage boy, who is apparently important enough to be performing all of this, you know, medical stuff on them, but not important enough to get a name or appear ever again, puts a pair of headphones on Nash and begins to play an Edith Piaf song called Non Je Ne Regrette Rien, which features strongly throughout the movie. And Arthur, he can kind of hear it too because he's actually sitting next to Nash on the train. And so they kind of realize that this is a signal that it's nearly time to wake up from the dream and they start to get a bit antsy. So the interrogation intensifies and they throw Sato face down onto the floor. But then he realizes that the rug is made out of polyester, not wool, and that he is in fact a dream, in a dream as well. So their plan is super fucked up now. And this is where everything starts to get really confusing because it's just dreams everywhere.
Sorry, is this where things start to get confusing?
Anyway, it is not his dream though, and it turns out it is in fact Nash's dream. And he is what is known as an architect who builds the dream for events to take place. So, and the mob that's coming is actually his subconscious who's realized that he's in a dream and his subconscious is coming to take out the people that are in his dream.
Yeah, defend him. Kind of.
So the mob swarms the group and they wake up on the Shinkansen and get off at the next station, leaving Sato behind. And he wakes up and he's like, what the fuck just happened? What? That was a dream? Okay, I'm just going to sit calmly on this train.
I'm going to go back to sleep. Good night, everybody.
So they all get off the train at different places and they start to get all their belongings together to flee the country as the person or the people who paid them to get the information out of Sato will be out to kill them. But they are, in fact, intercepted and picked up by none other than Sato, who is tipped off by the architect, Nash, who, just like the Japanese boy on the train, is very forgettable.
And gets carried away by two of Sato's guys, it looks like.
Yeah, so...
So,
and
sucks to be him.
Sato reveals he arranged their mission to test Cobb for a seemingly impossible job, implanting an idea in a person's subconscious, so not extraction, but in fact Inception, which is the name of the movie.
Insert the movie title
Inception.
Wow.
Well, it's a good thing that Batman was called Batman because he says he's Batman a lot. I'm Batman. But yeah, so thoughts so far, boys? I've been talking a lot.
It's great. It's a damn good opening.
A lot happens and it establishes the make-believe world very thoroughly.
Yeah.
It wastes no time in throwing you right into the silliness of it all as well.
Yeah.
and like it doesn't piss about for 40 minutes explaining dreams within dreams. It's like, all right, this is what's happening, and if you're not with me, you're going to be left behind, audience.
Yeah.
It doesn't hold hands, which is, you know, to its credit.
Yeah,
but it does heaps of good things for that, because it kind of, it tells you that there can be dreams within dreams, But then you also get the way they can work is they can all be in someone else's dream. And then obviously the architect plays a big role in that because he builds the whole dream. But then you also get the information about the kick.
Yep.
And you get death and pain in the world as well. Like, it all just kind of comes together really well.
And we are introduced to the little elusive spinny top as well, which ends up playing a really big part in the movie eventually.
Yeah, Cobb's totem.
But yeah, so Sato wants Cobb to convince Robert, the son of Sato's competitor, through Inception, to dissolve his father, Maurice Fisher's company. So Sato kills Nash and promises to clear Cobb's criminal status, which, honestly, I'm going to get into this later, but his criminal status actually doesn't make any fucking sense when we find out why he's a criminal, but that's fine. But yeah, so he just wants to come home to his children, and be back in America and be their daddy, which is, you know, pretty average, motivation for a character. But, you know, we'll move on. So Cobb accepts the offer, and against Arthur, so Joseph Gordon-Levitt's judgment, Cobb travels to Paris to find a dream architect. Cobb's father-in-law, Stephen Miles, which is, Michael Caine, sorry. Yeah, Michael Caine. I had like a...
Michael Caine.
I think I had an aneurysm for a second there. Yeah, he's kind of like Hugo Weaving. You know how Hugo Weaving always just plays Hugo Weaving no matter what he is in? Michael Caine just plays Michael Caine.
Oh, yeah. And I forgot how little he is in this too. He's in like three scenes.
Yeah. And
and barely does anything.
And he's like a powerhouse actor too. Like, and he's just like, yeah, I'll just show up a bit. Hello, I'm Michael Caine. Leonardo DiCaprio, you've got to be a father.
He is drastically underused in this movie, but I suppose after being in three great big blockbusters by the same guy right beforehand, you'd be like, yeah, I'm fine. You know, use me for what you want. Pay me my $20 million. I'll sit behind a desk and we'll go from there.
So...
And we'll talk.
Going back to the Michael Caine playing Michael Caine thing and the Hugo Weaving playing Hugo Weaving thing, I once met a guy in New Zealand and he was driving me to Rivendell, like to the place where Rivendell was to see Rivendell. And he goes, oh, you never noticed that, like, Hugo Weaving never changes his voice for anything. And then he played me a clip and it was, welcome to Rivendell, Mr. Anderson. It stuck. That was like 5 years ago, and I've never forgotten.
That's so weird.
Welcome to Rivendell, Mr. Anderson. Okay. So yeah. So Cobb's father-in-law introduces him to Ariadne. Weirdest name I've ever heard, but we'll go with it.
Yep. Yeah. Not a real name.
So she's a So it's played by Elliot Page. I think the one thing we're going to note: Elliot Page recently came out as trans. If we refer to Elliot Page as she, we're referring to Ariadne, the female character. Otherwise, we'll try our best to say they, them for the rest of it. But we're referring to the character. So a graduate student skilled in creating labyrinths, which I might add, I'm just going to carry on. So Cobb's father-in-law.
I was going to say, is that a major? Yeah, I major in labyrinths.
So... Yes, but it's funny, though, because he doesn't take a lot of convincing. He's like, no, you're not going to corrupt another one of my students. And he's like, come on. And then he's like, you know what? Go for it.
Yeah.
I'll give you my best student. What are you going to say?
So Cobb takes Ariadne out, and she draws him a maze. But if you pause the movie quickly, it is impossible to solve the maze. I paused the movie, and there's no way... into the middle of the maze. It's all blocked off. So it's like, oh yeah, that is impossible. Yeah, I can't solve it in a minute because I can never fucking solve it. Yeah.
That is a hard maze. Yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah, there's no way actually.
Yeah. She just draws a circle so there's no way in. Do this maze.
So Cobb introduces Ariadne to the basic rules in terms of dream sharing technology, such as a totem, which is an object that lets the person know they're not dreaming. Which I'm just wondering, a totem in a dream, wouldn't you just like have it in your pocket when you're awake, and then when you're in a dream, because you can pick, obviously they seem to be able to pick and choose what they bring into the dream. Why wouldn't they just not bring a totem into the dream? So then they go, oh, I put my hands in my pockets. Oh, I don't have a totem. I guess I'm in a dream. Like, why would they be like, here's my totem. Don't touch it. Oh, you touched it. Now you've ruined it. Like, it does. They don't.
Yeah,
they don't make sense.
The totem thing.
I was like, I've never thought of that.
The totem thing, it's just very odd. They're like, this is mine.
Yeah.
But it's never really explained as to why no one else can touch it. I never got that or followed what they were doing with it.
No. So the idea was if someone else touches it, then they can recreate that if you guys are dream sharing. Like if they're the architect, they can recreate your totem. So then you go, oh, I'm awake. And they would know the physics of it. So because Cobb's totem never stopped spinning in a dream, they would be like, okay, well, easy. I'm going to... But you could have probably guessed that, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah, make it so Cobb's never stopped spinning.
Yeah.
So, oh, makes it fall over. So he's like, oh, I'm in reality instead of a dream. Yeah.
Fair. Anyway, Kieran, carry on.
I'm already confused.
But yeah, like I said, they totems are introduced, but I think it's literally just introduced for the big ending, which we'll get to. But like I said, you could just be like, I've got a totem when I'm awake, but when I'm in a dream, I don't have one, so I know I'm in a dream. That's all I'm saying. But yeah, so, and he also tells her, like, what a kick is, which is a physical jolt that brings a dreamer out of a dream. So they kind of liken it to when you are falling asleep and then your brain does that weird thing where it thinks you're falling and then you go, whoa, and then you wake up. So they kind of recreate that, which also the physics of that doesn't make a lot of sense either, but I digress. We'll continue. So, and also, so Cobbs is a spinning top and he says to Ariadne, you need to make your own top, like, or your own totem. But I'm wondering, what is so unique about a spinning top? Because you know that everybody knows how a top works. Like, you know that if you spin a top, it's going to do that and then it's going to fall over eventually. But, and they're meant to be unique, but, like, what's so unique about his top? Like, what about his top in particular is so different to a regular top that nobody would understand?
Oh, I thought the same.
Yeah.
Especially the chess piece. Whatever way you flick it, it's going to fall that way. Like,
well, this...
Yeah, if I flick it forward, it's going to fall forward.
It doesn't make...
Like, this was... Oh, sorry, go on.
I was just saying it doesn't make sense.
I was going to say, like, the biggest problem that, like, I think... Because I watched this with my partner, and we were saying that throughout it, nothing's ever really surreal enough. Like, we do... Obviously, we do have a going down the line, there's the spinning corridor fights and the power streets exploding and whatnot. But everything in these dreams is pretty normal. Like, I have... There's no 12-foot-tall Amazonian women, you know, coming to abduct me from high school. Yeah.
Well,
and, you know, the stuff that's like my dreams. There's no... No one has sex dreams about their friends in these dreams.
Well, I'm just going to...
You delved into my...
There's no dinosaurs.
I'm going to be devil's advocate here because the whole point of this is they don't want the people to know that they're dreaming because they want them to think it's real life and that they're going to... you know, divulge information to them. So that's probably why it doesn't have any of the weird shit in it. Because by design, they want it to be as realistic as possible. But I will... Okay. I do have stuff to say about that anyway. But we'll get there.
Yeah, well... Yeah, no shameful sex dreams, which is what I think was really missing from this movie.
No going to school and realizing you're not wearing pants.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, here we go. Although Cobb's first rule is to never use memories to build dreams, the memory of his dead ex-wife, Marl, violently invades his shared dream with Ariadne, who shows up. So, like, they do the whole... this is the whole Paris scene. They're in Paris and everything explodes and then they go back into the dream. And Ariadne is doing too many crazy things. Here we go, Dane. This is in my notes. So, they're doing too many crazy things, right? So she's folding the world in on itself. She's creating new things, blah, blah, blah. And then the subconscious realizes that they're dreaming and that there's somebody else in the dream and then starts to attack her. And then that's when Mole shows up and stabs her in the stomach.
Yeah. And then that's answered my questions.
Then Ariadne is kind of like, what the fuck? Like,
I just got stabbed.
Who the fuck was that? Yeah, why did I get stabbed in your dream, bro? Like, that's actually kind of fucked. And then Cobbs is like, I don't want to talk about it. Leave me alone. And then that's the end of that for now. Cobb then travels to Mombasa to recruit Ames, a British forger played by none other than the very handsome, a very electric Tom Hardy.
Oh, my goodness.
I love Tom Hardy. I'm just going to say it right now.
Yep.
Even in Locke. We all love Tom Hardy. Even in Locke, which was a fucking terrible movie, I was still like, you know what?
Even
he's so dynamic.
Even if he's in two Venom movies, I still love him.
He just can do so much. Like, even with just one shot on him, like the smallest shot, like Dunkirk, he had like
the pilot
mask on. Half of his face was covered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then as Bane, half of his fucking face was covered, but he could still, like, he still fucking brought it every time. Oh, Tom Hardy's he's a fucking so good. Legend. Yeah. But yeah, and Yusuf as well. He's a Kenyan chemist, and he's going to aid with the mission as well because he has, like, a special concoction all mixed up for Cobb and his boys to go sleepy byes. So that's
good. It's just roofies. That's his secret.
Yeah.
Extra strong roofies.
Well, that's why they don't call them floories, right? Why do they call them roofies? You never end up on the roof. Yeah,
weird.
You always end up on the floor. But yeah. So then they all come back to Paris and they convene with Sato to discuss the plan. And Sato reveals, so they're all like, oh, yeah, he's going to go on the longest flight ever, which is Sydney to Los Angeles. How are we going to do it? He's going to be on a plane. Like, oh my God, there's so many working parts. And Sato, he's a fucking cool boy. He just buys the fucking airline and he's like, yo, what's up? I bought the airline. Let's fucking do it. So they're ready. They got all the stuff. Ames maintains that the incepted idea must be simple and seemingly self-generated. Like, you can't walk into a dream and, like, hold Cillian Murphy by the sides of his face and go, give up your father's company. You can't do
apparently
that.
Apparently that doesn't work. Yeah.
Yeah, apparently, in even though the realm of possibilities in this movie is endless, you can't do that. So they have to figure out, like, a way to make it feel organic.
Yeah. He thought of it himself. Dreamer. Yeah.
Yeah. So they decide that they're not going to just do one dream. They're not going to do two fucking dreams. They're doing three motherfucking dreams.
Oh,
so
my God.
A dream within a dream.
Within
a dream.
Yep.
Yeah.
A triple R.
It's a lot of snoozing going on. Yeah. And I think we also, like, I haven't really explained this, but every dream layer time, like, is longer, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's something that is a big part of the movie, that they have to, every time they go into a further layer of the dream, they have to also make up for a time difference. So, yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but, like, that's just part of the reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it? It's like a minute or so is 60 minutes in the next layer, and then it, like...
Yeah.
It triples or doubles or some shit, and just keeps getting more and more.
Something ridiculous. Yeah,
it just makes up its own rules as it goes along.
I think it's because it's going off of that thing where, like, you know, you'll have a dream and you'll wake up and realize, oh, I was only asleep for a couple of hours when it felt like you had a really long dream. I guess so the logic is kind of going off of the logic of, like, when you're asleep, when what people universally experience. But the rules,
I suppose well, with the rules, it's like, it's rules that Nolan has made up, so no one's gonna be able to be like, oh, he didn't do his research. That's not how it is.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not how dreams work.
So they make all these plans. They, like, send Tom Hardy's character out to kind of profile Robert's godfather, who's a big part of the company, and kind of learn about him and his mannerisms, because he's going to copy him in the dream. And they got to figure out a way to make him think of the idea of giving up his father's company by himself, so they really look into the relationship between Robert and his father during their planning. Ariadne becomes worried, so Cobb's having a little snooze, he's in a little dream, and he, because he's gone under so many times, he can't dream when he's sleeping. Normally he can only dream when he's actually under all of those drugs that make you go into Inception land. So she catches him asleep, so she kind of goes, hey, you know what, it would be a huge violation of his privacy if I just jumped into the dream with him, you know, I don't see any problem with that.
He's having a weird sex dream in there.
Yeah, that really annoyed
really
annoyed me, that part.
That was so strange. It's just like, wow, wouldn't you be like, you know what, you're not on my team because you just like violated my trust so hard. I was asleep and you fucking barged in there.
And he's their boss, kind of, I suppose.
Like, yeah.
She's been on the team for like 2 days.
Very intrusive.
He owns 51% of this company.
Yeah, and she's like, because she's just started and she thinks she's like, oh, her character, or sorry, Elliot's character in it, annoyed the shit out of me throughout this entire movie.
Yeah.
Just because of those reasons alone.
Yeah. But yeah, so she jumps into his bloody dream without his permission. And then
has a bit of a learns sticky that
he has a bit of a sticky dick, poke around. He's actually built like this kind of dream world for himself. I think it's kind of like, you know, like when you go to sleep and you were having a good dream and then you wake up and you're like, I'm just going to go back to sleep. I'm going to keep going with that dream for a little bit. Like everybody's done it. I think that's kind of what the logic is here, that like that the person who's the architect, or whenever you make a dream world for yourself, you can always revisit it because you made it.
Yeah, you can go back to it.
And it's your own little special place.
But
yeah, so he's made like a big shrine basically in his subconscious to his dead wife, which we realize she's dead, and basically reliving memories that he has with her in his dreams, because he's harboring a lot of feelings of guilt about her death, and that's why her projection keeps barging into his dreams and making a fucking mess of everything. So when Robert Fisher died, so Ariadne warns Cobb that he cannot keep Mal in his subconscious forever, and that he needs to tell everybody what the fuck is going on with him, because it could cause serious danger for everybody else, because he has no control over it, like it just keeps making trouble.
Is this the scene where she's in the elevator? Is this one? And she goes to the hotel room?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure when to bring this up, but Marion Cotillard, or however you pronounce her name, is, I think, terrifying in this movie. In this scene,
yes, she's scary.
Literally like scares the absolute crap out of me. The way she comes up to that elevator, and like this is after you've seen her stab Elliot, like Elliot Page's character, and then this scene, and there's so many scenes, she's so intense and just absolutely goddamn terrifying. And like I don't know if you guys know this, I'll just do a very quick fact, but Nolan originally envisioned this as a horror film about dream stealers. And like, that, I get major horror vibes every time she's on screen. I'm so scared of her in this movie.
She does like the Hannibal Lecter, Anthony Hopkins, no blinky thing.
And
it's just so intense. And she is so good.
She's so good in this movie.
She's so bloody good.
And I love it too, because like you see, like she is haunting Cobb's world, and like you see it, like. It's so good. She's incredible.
And
she's
the classic like femme fatale as well. Like she just shows up whenever she fucking wants, and she's sexy and she causes trouble. And she keeps saying like that we're waiting for a train like thing over and over again, which gets really fucking creepy by the end.
Yeah.
What were you gonna say, Dane?
I was gonna say with the whole horror vibes, because I read the same thing, Ryan, that was gonna be like a little horror movie. All I could picture is her. Did either of you ever play the Fear games?
Yeah.
Like a little old, like a little Alma that just pops up, scaring the absolute living piss out of you.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, they were good games.
I wish it was a horror. I think I would prefer this movie if it was a horror.
It would be really cool.
Yeah.
Would be way cooler.
Mm.
But he just can't. He can't help himself with his little action, science fiction, espionage movies. He can't help himself. He just wants to mash all of the genres together and make his own Nolan genre.
He sure does. The Nolanverse.
Yeah. So Robert Fisher's father, Maurice, dies, and the team decides to execute their plan on the Trans-Pacific flight from Sydney to Los Angeles, where they bought the airline, so it's all good, and then Robert's going to be a passenger on it in first class, mind you. Very Ooh. Fancy.
Free champagne, please.
So on the plane, Cobb discreetly spikes Robert's drink with a sedative, which I'm kind of like, why didn't you just get... Because you've got an air hostess, and the air hostess was in on the whole thing.
Yeah. Like, why didn't she just spike it?
She was literally... Yeah, like, she literally has the shit. Like, she has the stuff in the compartment that she goes and gets out. So she knows that something's going on and that he's going to be asleep. Like, they've obviously told her, hey, we're going to put this guy to sleep and you need to get this thing and then give it to us because we're going to do this with it. Why didn't she just give him a spiked drink? Like, why did we have to have the whole, ooh, Leonardo DiCaprio, it's the Nicky with his roofies. Ooh, la, la. Oh.
At least it's not as bad as the Prometheus spiking scene. Do you guys remember that? With Michael Fassbender.
I actually went...
And he literally like sticks his finger in the guy's drink and the guy looks at him and he does it and then hands him the drink and he's like, cool, thanks, and just drinks it.
I actually... funny story. I was like, you know what? I feel like watching something like kind of spooky but kind of action-y. Put Prometheus on and I watched probably... I've watched it probably twice and I put it on for about... I watched about 5 minutes and then I just was like, you know what? It's a no
I'm
for
good.
Me, and I switched it right the fuck off.
It ruined the entire universe of Alien. Oh. Like, Ryan, I know that you've said it's the most beautiful movie you've ever hated. I just fucking flat-out hated that movie. Look, it made me so very angry.
I'm going to make an executive decision right now. We're never fucking watching that movie. It literally just gives me a headache.
I was about to say, we should do it on the show, but maybe we won't. Because... There's a lot of anger from all three of us.
I'd like to.
I literally don't think I can sit through that movie.
Oh, talking about pretentious.
I only watch it the once.
That movie is pretentious.
Yeah. It's like, hey, you remember all of those good things you love about Alien? Well, forget all about them. Because here this is.
I don't know. I think we really should. I think maybe Ryan and I have outvoted you.
Oh,
executive
man.
Decision.
I'm not watching it. This is going to be like year 11 English where I don't read the book. I'm not...
Just give me a synopsis online.
I'm going to get the Cliffs notes.
I'm going to sign up to all these dodgy websites to get book reports.
Yeah. But yeah, so... He spikes his drink with his roofies and the team enters into a shared dream with Robert... And in this one, Yusuf is the architect, which I'm also like, okay, so how does the architect, so they've got Ariadne as the architect, right? Mm. So does she make all the dreams up and then she goes, here's what the dream's going to look like. And they have to sit there and be like, okay, I'm going to remember all of this stuff because there's a different dreamer and architect for each level. Like, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I had no idea. I thought Ariadne was the architect.
She was the architect, so she made the layout.
Okay,
but
it's not...
The people... So everybody, the person who stays awake each time is the dreamer of that dream. So Yusuf is the driver of the van while everybody's in the van because he's actually the dreamer and he's the one who's dreaming up Los Angeles, like...
Yeah.
That they're driving through.
Yeah, I get
so
it.
So by design, does that mean that Ariadne made up and was like, here you go, Yusuf, this is what you have to dream?
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense. But yeah, so at each dream level, the person generating the dream stays behind to set up a kick to awaken other team members from the deeper dream. And these kicks must occur simultaneously despite time flowing faster in each successive level. And that they use the song from the beginning to do that. That's the same song that they use every time. So the first level is Yusuf's dream of Los Angeles.
In the pouring rain?
In the pouring rain. So they managed to take Robert hostage, but they're immediately ambushed by a team of rifle-wielding assailants, revealing that Robert's been trained to protect himself subconsciously, because obviously this is a very big problem over there in this universe. People going in your dreams and stealing stuff. So Saito gets shot in this dream by one of the boys, because they're just, there's bullets flying everywhere. And Cobb realizes too late that experts have helped Robert militarize his subconscious against unwanted extraction. Mm-hmm. And during a car chase, trying to hide from the gun-toting men, a train from Cobb's subconscious plows through the middle of the street for some fucking reason. And just causes even more mayhem. And you'd think by that point that the bloke who was...
Yeah.
They're trying to get the information out of would go, hey, this isn't normal. There's no train tracks around here. Am I in a dream?
Where did this train come from? How weird.
And then, yeah. So to make matters worse, Yusuf's powerful sedative may leave whomever is killed in the dream in limbo, which is unconstructed dream space. And even though they're a bit like, oh, shit, this is really bad, they're kind of like, well, we're going to be either stuck in here and all get killed and put into limbo, or we could go into the next dream space and keep going. So they all decide to go on with the plan. So, concerned for the team's safety, Ariadne asks Cobb what the heck is going on with him and his dead wife. And Cobb reveals that he and Mole had been in limbo before. And they were sedated for 5 hours of real time, but they spent 50 years in a dream world. And things started to get a little hazy and... they weren't really sure what was real and what was fake anymore because they spent so long there. And when Mal refused to return to reality, Cobb used a form of inception by reactivating her totem, which is the little spinny top. So Cobb's little spinny top was actually originally his wife's, which, like I said, spinning tops are not that special. Everybody knows how fucking spinny top works. That chick was doomed from the start. So after waking up, from the dream space. So they ended up, like, becoming old people in the dream space. And then they put their heads on the train tracks and committed suicide to wake up. And she still believed when she woke up in reality that she was dreaming. When she kept trying to convince Cobb, like, to wake, to get themselves back into the dream by committing suicide. She ends up framing Cobb for her murder, and this is where I brought up before, his criminal status doesn't make a lot of sense when you think about it. So she sets up the hotel room to make it look like they had a big fight and that he pushed her out the window. And when what she does is she waits at a hotel across the road on the same floor with a window that looks directly in to the other window, and then Cobb shows up and everything's a mess and he's like, where the fuck is my wife? And she's like, hey, baby, I'm out across the road. Come and get me. And so they're, like, yelling and carrying on across the street, which I'm wondering. They're yelling and carrying on. How have people not looked up and gone, oh, there's a chick standing on that ledge over there. Mm. And the guy is all the way over there. And she's going to jump off the building and he's nowhere near her. And then he doesn't convince her to
not
step
jump.
Back in and yeah. She... throws herself off the building and she dies. But then he has to flee the country because she did all of this stuff. Like, she called her psychologist and said she was afraid of him and everything like that. And, you know, messed up the hotel room and stuff. So he flees the country and he leaves his children with his father-in-law, which is Michael Caine. But to be honest, if he just hung around and waited for forensics, they would have proved that she jumped out another window. Like,
And you think that there would be security cameras and all sorts of things outside of the building to end in.
And then people...
eyewitnesses. Would assume. There people were people who heard it.
Yeah. Like. Yeah, people who probably would have seen it, because, like, if it was set in, you know, LA or New York or somewhere where it looked like it was set, surely somebody would have fucking been at the bottom when she fell and they could have gone, oh, she's facing this way. Like, she fell face down.
Yeah. She might have done a sick twist or something on the way down.
Do a flip!
Do a big flip!
Yeah.
Also, just be like, just go next door and dust for her prints because she's rented two rooms.
Two rooms. Yep, next to each other. Yeah.
I know people have a lot to say about the American justice system, but surely they could have figured that one out.
Oh, God.
Like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, very strange.
Yeah, like, he's like, oh shit, I'm a criminal now. I better run. Without waiting to see if anybody was like, hey, you're a criminal. But then, obviously, they must have thought he was a criminal because he wasn't allowed back in the country. Or was he just assuming?
Mm.
You know what they say about assuming, right, boys? It makes an ass out of you and me.
Tickle I did, all right.
You can have
yeah,
it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, I don't know. It's a bit weird. I don't know. The whole scene is...
It doesn't make sense.
No. It's a really well-made scene, but it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I'm like, obviously
she... Like, it was a really tense... It was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, obviously she was desperate for Cobb and her to escape this dream world that she believed she was in. But then... Yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. Like, yeah. Framing your husband, leaving
really
your kids.
She really wanted...
Yeah.
Yeah. She wanted him to, like, she made it so that he had no... She wanted.
Yeah.
She thought that she had made it that he would have no choice but to join her and jump off the building with her. But he knew that he was in reality.
Yeah.
And knew, hey, you know, you're not going to wake up. You're going to be fucking splatty, kapooey, on the floor, dead boy.
Mm.
So it just didn't work out how she thought that she would.
Yeah.
How? Yeah. But, yeah, I guess in the Nolan verse, anything goes, you know?
Mm.
But, yeah, so...
couldn't Michael Caine move his kids out of the country?
Yeah.
If Leo can't return home, why doesn't he, like, Michael Caine just take him to Europe? That's where Leo's been hanging out.
Yeah, because Michael Caine was in Europe.
And credits.
Yeah, because, like... That's what he's like, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, you know, Paris has some of the most difficult extradition laws that possibly exist. And it's like, okay, why don't you just live there with your children then?
If you're never going to get extradited.
Can I just say, with that line, with that line there, that's actually a line that's uttered in Catch Me If You Can.
Ah,
it's a cheeky little nod.
Cheeky
little nod to the other character.
I love that. That's very cool. I love that movie.
I was going
to
say, that movie is so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Spielberg.
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Spielberg.
I was about to say, is it Spielberg?
It is.
I don't want to burst the bubble too much, but have you guys heard about how much of that guy's story's been refuted now?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
That's okay. That doesn't ruin the movie for me.
Oh, well,
it's still
good.
A fun movie.
Yeah, if you look into it, yeah. Apparently, yeah. Not much of it's actually that true. He's just a real good storyteller.
Well, I mean, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you see where he ended up. He's obviously very good at fucking lying.
Yeah.
Mm.